Hey, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Welcome to the program tonight. How you doing? Did you watch the Academy Awards last night? That was the best Academy Awards that I've seen in a long time. I think a lot of thanks goes to... Why am I talking about this? Oh, what the hell? Because I like the Academy Awards. I usually like to watch it because I know there's going to be a lot of screw-ups and a lot of weirdness. But there wasn't last night. Hugh Jackman is really great. I had no idea that my X-Man was a song and dance guy, too. Whoa! Unbelievable. I was glad to see that the awards won by all the pictures that won awards. The screenplay writer for Harvey Milk, that was great. Sean Penn's acceptance speech was great. Slumdog Millionaire, which Kathy and I saw, what was it, about a month or so ago, about 6 weeks ago? I thought that was great. It was, we had fun. We made an enormous pan of popcorn and hooked Molly up to her little video player and let her watch, I think, The Neverending Story, and put her in between us in the bed, and she got all cuddled up and watched her movie on the video player with the headphones on, and Kathy and I ate popcorn and watched the Academy Awards. What did you do? I know nobody gives a damn about what we do at the Academy Awards, but I thought it was a good show last night. I really liked it. I'll tell you the part I liked the best. What the hell? The way when they have the best supporting actors now, or the best actors and best actresses, and how they have five former winners come out, and each one addresses specifically face up one of the candidates for the award that night. I thought that was great. Whoever came up with that idea is has obviously got a Facebook or a MySpace page or whatever you call it. Ah, did you like it? So did I. All right, moving right along to all the death and destruction that is the United States of America today. Hey, listen, are you aware of this concerted attack? It's not just the filthy pig man, the head of the Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh, or the hoe from Wasilla, or Larry the Cable, Joe the Plumber. No. The attack against Barack Obama is just very far-reaching and is starting to develop tentacles. And it's astonishing to me. The time may come when we may have to take up arms to defend our president, to defend the Constitution of the United States. If these right-wingers continue, have you heard or seen the video clip of Alan Keyes? I know the right racial language to use, but I'm not supposed to because I'm a white man. But, I'm not talking about the N-word. No, I'm not talking about the N-word. There's other ways to talk about what Alan Keyes is without ever going near the N-word. But Alan Keyes and Richard Shelby, this mush-mouthed white man. Now, see, I can talk about him because he's white, and so am I. Alan Keyes is a punk. Alan Keyes is just a punk. But, I would love, I'll tell you what, if I get 8 or 9 black folk to give me permission via email, I will rip him a new vest pocket here before the evening's over. But Alan Keyes, and Richard Shelby, and who else is on Barack Obama today? It's not just Obama, it's also Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Did you hear what former baseball player Jim Bunning, a senator, what he had to say? It's just sickening. I don't know which way to turn these days. Do you? It's getting pretty bad. But Richard Shelby gave an interview to the Cullman, Alabama Times. I have been in Cullman, Alabama. I mentioned before that I worked for Look magazine in circulation way back in the day when it was considered to be here in the South that N-word magazine. Oh, you work for that N-word magazine? God damn, boy, what you doing in her? Well, sir, my job was to go into small markets in the South. By market, I don't mean demographic areas. I mean stores. Like Rexall drugstores and these mom-and-pop drugstores all over the South, everything from Jacksonville to Cullman, Alabama, to Huntsville, to Rocky Mount, North Carolina, to, God, There are very few small towns in the old Confederacy that I've not been in. And it was a pretty dangerous job, but I was young and stupid, and I did it because I thought it was kind of fun. I had my windshield shot at only one time, and never had tires slashed, never got beaten up. And went about the South, white man working for Look Magazine back in the mid-60s, early to mid-60s, unarmed. I was even unarmed. I can't believe that. Boy, I wouldn't do that now. I don't do that now. But anyway, I spent one time, I got to Cullman, Alabama, and had a very nasty experience in Cullman, Alabama, with somebody who owned a Rexall drugstore, who had on display Look magazines. Why? I don't know. But they were doing a retrospective of the Freedom Riders from a couple of years earlier. The Freedom Riders who got on the Greyhound buses in cities in the North and rode to the South to protest segregated buses. See, back in the day, I don't know how many folks know this, but back in the day, you would get on a Greyhound bus in Cleveland. And if you were a colored person, you could sit on the bus anywhere you want to. When the bus got to essentially the old Mason-Dixon line, all the white folks would just couldn't wait for it because the colored folks would have to get in the back of the Greyhound and the white folks could move up. And once you crossed into these southern states, if you were on a Greyhound, if you were a colored person, as they were so quaintly called back then, if you were a colored person, once you crossed into the old South, better not get off the bus to pee or use a bathroom or go get a candy bar or an ROC Coca-Cola or whatever you wanted to do. Better not do it. Yeah, there were colored bathrooms and colored drinking fountains most places. But if you wound up in a small town like, Cullman, Alabama, you see, where the bus station, the Greyhound bus station, was also a drugstore and a post office branch and a hardware store. You understand what I'm saying here, truth seekers? If you happen to get off the bus there and you were a colored person, odds are you might not get back on the bus. And you know who would care? Nobody except your kinfolk back in Cleveland. And when they came down to find out in Cullman, Alabama, what happened to you, the local sheriff said, "Well, I don't know about that boy. I have no idea. You say he came down here on the bus? Did he really? And what happened? He just disappeared." Well, I'll be darned. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? "Hey, Luke, you heard anything about this boy coming?" No, my deputy ain't heard nothing about it neither. Sorry. Now, y'all better go and get out of here before the sun sets, if you know what I mean. I have been there. I have heard that. I have seen it. I have watched it. And the only thing that protected me was the ability back then to keep my mouth shut and my white skin. That's it. Richard Shelby. Richard Shelby was in Cullman, Alabama, in a meeting with some of his constituents. And according to the Cullman, Alabama Times, they reported that Senator Shelby appeared to give some thought to rumors questioning Barack Obama's citizenship. A local resident asked Senator Shelby, "Senator, any truth to the rumor that appeared during the presidential campaign concerning that boy, the president's U.S. citizenship, Senator?" And Shelby answered this way, quote, "Well, his father was Kenyan, and they said he was born in Hawaii, but I ain't seen any birth certificate. And you know you have to be born American to be a president." End quote. Now, If Shelby, all during the Bush years, through most of the Bush years, was the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. Let's see. 1 + 1 = 2. 2 + 2 = 4. Oh, that's right. Yeah, the Senate Banking Committee. Senator Shelby, God only knows how much payola he got under the table to turn the other way, while these Republicans ruined, raped, pillaged, and destroyed the capitalistic system that was about to die in this country anyway. They knew it was going to die, so they decided to feed and eat and rip as much as they could. But Senator Richard Shelby knows damn good and well that Barack Obama, truth be told, is more of a citizen of this country than Richard Shelby is. How about that?
Well, how could that be, Mike?
Well, because Barack Obama is not some white, nasty, bloated, racist pig who would just as soon see the country dissolve, who would just as soon see some kind of a white supremacist, fascist outfit running the United States of America, so all them colored folk and all them immigrants and all them queers, and you know what, them women ought to shut up and sit down too, so that everybody would know their place, which is not quite what America is supposed to be about. Consequently, therefore, i.e., Richard Shelby is a punk who has less claim to citizenship in this country than Barack Obama. Oh, there's more. I'm just getting wound up. Stick around.
The same thing for the Navy when ships go to sea. All they got is a mess boy's job for me, Uncle Sam says. Keep on your apron, son. You know I ain't gonna let you shoot my big Navy gun. Got my long government letters, my time to go. When I got to the Army, found the same old Jim Crow, Uncle Sam says. Two camps for black and white. But when trouble starts, we'll all be in that same big fight.
Conservatives, don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
It is 23 past the hour. Okay, I've gotten permission from several folks who are in position to give that permission for me to go after Alan Keyes in a way that white folk might not understand, but black people would. But I just don't want to risk it because somebody may tune in and hear and go, what in the hell? But you all know, and I know, and so enough said about Alan Keyes. But Andrew Sullivan, in his Daily Dish feature at the Atlantic magazine website, had this incredibly weird video of Alan Keyes. I don't know how far somebody can go before they can be charged with threatening the life of the President of the United States. But Keyes, there he is, ranting against Obama with a form of violence, verbal violence. You know, Alan Keyes is off his nut. There's no question about that. This man is insane. This old pop-eyed freak needs to get on some thyroid medication. Well, no, maybe not. Now, stay off the thyroid medication there, Alan, and your ass is going to fry internally. I mean, he is. He's one of these pop-eyed people that needs to have his thyroid looked at. But this violent strain that is flourishing in this country again. You know, just when you think, well, you know, maybe things are calming down. No, they're not. It's incredible how many people. Setting aside, let's forget the politics and go right for the symbolism. The symbolism of the election of Barack Obama, it didn't erase 350 years of racism and murder and lynchings. It damn sure didn't. But it offered hope, I think, to an awful lot of white people who are just so tired of carrying the burden of their own racism. This was a chance for white folks to say, okay, damn, finally. And I think it was a load off the back of black people, too, who could say, how in the hell did this happen? Because let's face it, black folk constitute what now? About 11% of the population. So it meant that an awful lot of white people voted for Barack Obama. So whether you're black or white, there was a moment when you could look at his winning of the nomination and then going on to win the presidency, where you could be forgiven if you gave yourself just a little bit of a moment of like, damn, are we going to get through this? We're going to get through this. The whole race thing might be, listen, you know what your mama told you, don't count your chickens before they're hatched. What the election of Barack Obama has done for the sick people in this country, the racists, the real haters, is to give them a whole new focus. And the virulence, the ugliness, the hatred, the cowardice, this is what Eric Holder was talking about the other day. And so many commentators, not just in that some poll of trash Fox News, but it's all over the place. People, Eric Holder said we're a nation of cowards about race. You know, they add that about race. We're a nation of cowards about race. And Eric Holder, of course, is exactly spot on, as the expression is now. Of course, this country has been cowardly about race. Oh, my God. How could it not? You know, you suppress people for 350 years and you're white. You know, you might wake up in the middle of the night if you're running some plantation in the back swamps of Mississippi and you hear noises out back. And the year is 1859, and you may sit up and go, is that them Negroes coming up here to kill me? I mean, come on. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malone.
I'm not black, but there's a whole lot of times I wish I could say I'm not white. But I've seen the fires burning and the local people turning on the merchants and the shops who used to sell their brooms and mops.
25 before the hour. All right, I've gotten a lot of emails from folks who say, yeah, you've got our permission to go ahead on Alan Keyes, but I still hesitate. I really do. But as Andrew Sullivan, I think this Andrew Sullivan said this, there's a violent strain in America that stretches from Nathan Bedford Forrest. You know, he's the guy who came up with the brilliant idea of the Klan, all the way to Fred Phelps, the sick son of a bitch who likes to stand around talking about God hates queers or God hates fags or whatever. It is. This country produces more than our share of people who are absolutely insane. Alan Keyes happens to be one. Richard Shelby happens to be one. Dick Cheney. I mean, the list is there if you want to go down the list. But what Alan Keyes said, his words might spark the next domestic terrorist. Just like the Turner Diaries inspired Timothy McVeigh. Alan Keyes, I don't want to call him a house Negro. Back in the day of slavery, as all black folk know, I don't know how many white people know it, but the house Negro and the field hand, there's a totally different dynamic for slaves who eventually graduated to working in the house, you see, where they'd be around the white people. The field hands, the field Negroes, had to stay out and do the terrible work. And there were gradations. Some of it was based on what degree of darkness your skin was. In so many instances, the white massa would visit the quarters in the evening have sex with female slaves, so that eventually you had all these kids running around, and eventually they became teenagers and young people, young adults, who carried the genes of the white massa and also the black woman that just got raped by this guy. So the dynamic on a plantation, the dynamic between white and black back then, whew, was pretty messed up. I mean, it was pretty messed up. either as a form of survival or as a way of saying to his brothers and sisters, I'm better than you are, or a combination of both. The House Negro had that position. The House Negro would do whatever he had to do to maintain his position. And that included, up to and including, telling on other members of the slave family that worked on that plantation. The House Negro would hear things, and he would go to the white massa or the white mistress, and he would rat out his own brothers and sisters. Now, why did he do that? Well, he did it for the simple reason of ingratiating himself to the white folks who owned his ass, just like they owned the people that work out chopping cotton or handing tobacco. They also owned him. But he had a little bit better. He got to wear white people's clothes. He got to collect the scraps off the white people's table and eat those. And, you know, it's really sick stuff. It really is. Alan Keyes defines the House Negro. He sucks up to white people in a way that even to me as a white man is stomach turning. I have never seen anyone do this. Alan Keyes, you know, I compare Alan Keyes, and don't send me emails saying how dare you, but I compare him to somebody like Malcolm X or Jesse Jackson, Julian Bond. Pick a black man over the past 50, 75 years during black struggle where it really came out and compare it to this toady, this little slimy rat. Alan Keyes. It's incredible. Alan Keyes would do anything just to be considered by white people, not by himself, but by white people, to be a cut above the rest of his black brethren and sisters. Even the ones who have so far exceeded Alan Keyes, Alan Keyes knows what he is. He knows what he is. So he talks about the President of the United States. The President of the United States. And the question is, are Republicans so desperate for any black face to be part of their insane posse that they'll look the other way when some piece of waste, some House Negro like Alan Keyes says the things he says? He called President Obama an abomination. He said, quote, we have to stop him or the U.S. will cease to exist, end quote. He says, quote, the military should think about not obeying Obama because he's not rightly the president of the United States, end quote. What? Wouldn't you think that if this sump hole of racism, which is the Republican Party, this nest of white Southern pod people like Rich Shelby, don't you think that if there's anyone left in the Republican Party that had an ounce of honor, an ounce of ethical center, an ounce of morality, would have? Alan Keyes said this Saturday. Don't you think at least one Republican? Because you see, Alan Keyes considers himself Republican. Christ, wouldn't you think there'd be one Republican who would say, this is insane. Get this man away from our party. Have you heard anything? Let me see. Do I hear anything out there? Do I hear anything? You know, I'll be damned. All I hear out here in the foothills of North Georgia Mountains about this topic are crickets. Wait a minute. Let me try again. Do I hear any Republicans out there talking about what Alan Keyes said about our press? Hello? No, don't hear a thing. Don't hear a thing. The fact that the Republicans are not responding to what Alan Keyes said, to what Richard Shelby said, and every day there's a new one. Every day. Now they've got this House Negro. They've got Alan Keyes. And don't you know, I'll tell you something, white people like Richard Shelby, when they sit around with their bourbon and branch water and their big old fat ass cigars and they're sitting around on Haley Barber's front porch down there in Mississippi, you know what? On a Sunday, on a summer evening, and the subject of Alan Keyes come up, I cannot even tell you. You are going to have to use your own imagination as to what they say about a black man like Alan Keyes, who is desperate to get approval from white people, to the point that he would say these things about the President of the United States, who just by coincidence happens to be a black man. I have seen an awful lot. I remember when Emmett Till was murdered. I remember when the three civil rights workers from up north were butchered in Philadelphia, Mississippi. I mean, I remember Medgar Evers. I'm not that old, but I've seen all of this, and I've had to deal with my own racism over the entire course of my life. And then I hear somebody like Richard Shelby, somebody like Haley Barbour, somebody like Jeff Sessions, and somebody like Alan Keyes. And I just think to myself, dear God, you know what's going to take? It's going to take a whole generation needs to die off. My generation needs to die off. And then maybe the generation come up behind us and the one behind that, there might be some salvation. But this generation of which I'm a part, it needs to be scoured off the planet. And that includes people like Shelby and Alan Keyes. And the list goes on and on, this Fred Phelps character, on and on and on. I mean, it's astonishing that a country that claims to be what we've always claimed to be, which always was a goddamn lie, you know that as well as I do. You know it was a lie. But somehow there were enough people in this country who thought to themselves, you know, we do have one thing here. We've got the Bill of Rights. We've got freedom of expression. We can organize. We can overcome some of this stuff. And I think about how our kids were taught history, American government, and all the decent people, black, white, Jew, Gentile, whatever, in this country who have desperately tried to meet the standard that the framers played with. They didn't really set it out there. They didn't have the courage to take it one step further. You know, you can read in history, well, George Washington wanted to free all the slaves on his death, but he was afraid to leave it in his will because Martha's family might get pissed off. Thomas Jefferson, it was okay to have sex with Sally Hemings and have a whole passel of half-black, half-white chillens. I mean, the framers, let's be real, okay? Can we get real on this program? The framers knew what was going on. So there have been people who have tried in the history of this country to rise to the standards, not the conduct or behavior or example set by the framers, but the things they talked about in theory. And look where we are now.
Go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. There's a whole clutch of people that are actively promoting violence in this country. Alan Keyes is one. Pat Robertson is one. The fat man, Rush Limbaugh, is one. You know the list. The list goes on and on and on and on. And some of the people who promote violence in a very slithery kind of way, you know, so you can't, well, I didn't say that. You know, you pin them down. Well, prove it. You know,
When did I say that?
Some of them are embedded in media, and that's what makes them even more irresponsible, is that one would think they would know better. And, of course, that's a stretch on my part. And then there are some who are not embedded in media who do everything that they can to disturb and destroy this country. And I don't know. It's pretty resilient, this country. If you take a look at our history, what we've gone through, what we've done to other people, what we have somehow managed to survive inside this country and globally, the damage that we, and I'm talking about the power in this country, what we've done, the damage that we've done to our fellow citizens and the indigenous people that were here to begin with is unspeakable. It's just unspeakable. And therefore, we don't talk about it. Okay. Cowboys and Indians. we have a black man for president now, so come on, Malloy, get off that crap. Racism dead.
Okay.
Fair enough. Jim Bunning, U.S. Senator from Kentucky, another freak from Kentucky, just like Mitch McConnell. What's up with you people in Kentucky? Where do these people come from? You know, the people in Kentucky, I'll bet you the vast majority would say gay folks should never get married, and yet they send Mitch McConnell to the Senate. Oh, gay folks should not get married to each other. I have you. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Jim Bunning, when I was a kid, he was a baseball player. And I remember his name from way back in the day, from, you know, Saturday afternoons, listen to radio, Toledo, Ohio. Jim Bunning. Who did he play for? Did he play for the Detroit Tigers? Was it Tigers? And he was just a name to me back then. He was just a baseball player. And I loved baseball back when I was a kid. Oh, my God. I had a Ralph Kiner mitt. I thought Al Rosen was the greatest third baseman in the history. I thought Larry Doby, oh my God, a black man in center field for the Cleveland Indians. How did that happen? Jimmy Pearsall, when the movie came out, Fear Strikes Out. I mean, just Al Kaline for the Detroit Tigers. I mean, just on and on and on and on and on and on. And Jim Bunning was just one of those names. He was a baseball player. And because he was a baseball player, to me, he was kind of special. This is back in the day when baseball players made just about what the average factory worker made, plus maybe 10 grand a year. Back when baseball was a sport and not a goddamn sump hole of drug addiction and needles and filth and multi-million dollar contract. You know what I'm saying. But Bunning, Jim Bunning, over the weekend, he said that U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be dead very soon. She's going to be dead. He gave a 30-minute speech on Saturday at something called the Hardin County Republican Party's Lincoln Day Dinner. Can you imagine that? In Kentucky, someone like Jim Bunning attending something called the Lincoln Day Dinner. Isn't that funny? See what I mean? Anyway, Bunning said he supports conservative judges. And, quote, that's going to be in place very shortly because Ruth Bader Ginsburg has cancer, bad cancer, the kind you don't get better from, end quote. He was at the Old State Theater in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as you may know, who's in her late 70s, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer earlier in February. Surgeons removed a very small tumor that had not spread. Doctors termed it stage one. I know it's pancreatic cancer, but anyway, meaning they found it in the early stages when it's most curable, possibly before it metastasized. But she also had colon cancer. But is it Jim Bunning's place to kind of, I don't know if he said it with a grin on his face, since he is a white Southern male, he probably has very little use for Jewish females who happen to be Supreme Court justices. I mean, come on. It's not just racism that exists down here like grits and hog fat. It's also anti-Semitism. It's anti-Catholicism. oh, Jesus. There's a mean streak against women. I mean, come on. This is the South. This is the United States South. And any white Southerner who denies what I just said is a damn liar or an ignorant fool. Black folk know what I'm talking about. But there's Jim Bunny, kind of gleefully, this is my impression anyway, talking about, well, I like conservative judges, and you know what? A Jewish broad's soon going to die, so we're going to put one in her place. Did he say Jewish broad? No. Did he mean that? You're damn right he did. Only left out liberal. That damn liberal Jewish broad. Man. I don't know. And doesn't Christianity teach something about loving your neighbor and treating a stranger in your country as well as you, better than you treat yourself, and suffer the children to come to me because such is the kingdom of God, and on and on and on and on and on, huh? Right? All right, we'll be back after the break. The U.S. military has released, or the Pentagon has released, a report about Guantanamo that you probably are going to find is as hysterical as I found it. It sounds like something out of Catch-22. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. Hey, hour two of the Malloy program tonight. Thanks for sticking around. There's something occurred today called the Fiscal Responsibility Summit. Fiscal Responsibility Summit. I love government talk, right? Even when it's sincere, I think most of the things that Barack Obama most of the things Barack Obama has said, these conferences and his directives and so on and so forth, the language has been fairly clear, fairly consistent, not a lot of gobbledygook. Fiscal Responsibility Summit. Okay. Now, what he did, he held a very bipartisan summit today, and he had people there from Democrats, from the Democratic caucus, the Republican caucus. He had some people there from the academy, people there from business. I mean, just a whole mush of people. But the thing that impressed me was he had Republicans. He invited Republicans. Can you imagine Dick Cheney or George Bush doing this? No, of course you can't. But the summit today, the focus was supposed to be on fiscal responsibility, how best to dig out from the enormous stinking economic dung heap that the Bush crime family dumped on this nation. There were economists there, like I mentioned, Republican and Democratic lawmakers. And President Obama actually took questions from everybody, invited in the press. It was wide open. Can you imagine something like this during 8 years of the satanic rule of this country that we had under Bush? Right? Press was there. Democrat, everybody. Asked me questions. Unscripted. Took questions from Republicans without a Karl Rove or Dick Cheney type lurking around with a hidden mic and earpiece. It's amazing. The first Q&A, the first question, Barack Obama called on former presidential rival John McCain to get the ball rolling. President Obama said to McCain, I'm paraphrasing, something like, John, you want to get things started here? So what pressing economic matter is most urgent to John McCain as the U.S. economy is nosediving? What would be, of all the issues that we're facing, health care, unemployment, job loss, unemployment compensation, redoing taxes, housing, education, all of it. What did McCain come up with?
We all know how large the defense budget is. We all know that the cost overruns. Your helicopter is now going to cost as much as Air Force One. I don't think that there's any more graphic demonstration of how good ideas have cost taxpayers an enormous amount of money. So we're going to have to pay for Afghanistan, as you well know, and we're not done in Iraq. But most importantly, we have to make some tough decisions, or you, Mr. President, have to make some tough decisions about not only what we procure, but how we procure it.
Well, Jonathan, this is going to be one of our highest priorities. By the way, I've already talked to Gates about a thorough review of the helicopter situation. The helicopter I have now seems perfectly adequate to me. Of course, I've never had a helicopter before. So, you know, maybe I've been deprived and I didn't know it. But I think it is an example of the procurement process gone amok, and we're going to have to fix it.
And whose procurement process are we talking about? Of course, right. But of all the earth-shaking events that have occurred in this country in the age of Bush, the destruction of everything in sight, the shredding of the Constitution, the turning of the United States into a quasi-police state. We're just one labor strike away from martial law in this country. You don't think Obama would declare it? With all of this stuff, and this moron McCain asks about the presidential helicopter, and he cites that as procurement gone amok? That? A helicopter or two or three? Are you kidding me? John, how about addressing the $50 billion that was stolen in Iraq by... you don't want to speculate that it could have been high-ranking military officers, American military officers that stole it, do you, John? How about contractors? Some of those sacrosanct contractors like KBR and Halliburton. How about maybe some of the private security firms? Huh? No, let's focus on the presidential helicopter. Incredible. You know, you put 5 minutes of rhetoric from Barack Obama against 5 minutes of rhetoric from, political or otherwise, from John McCain. And you have the difference between an educated man and somebody that couldn't find his ass with both hands. The educated man being the president, the jerk being, what's his name, McCain. Unbelievable. And if you saw the picture, if you saw any of the live pictures or even a couple of stills that are making the rounds now, who do you suppose was on either side of McCain? Right. Lindsey Graham on McCain's left and Lieberman on McCain's right. You talk about three people that I don't, what is up with these three? Especially Lieberman. How could he attach himself like a lamprey onto this poor sorry son of a bitch that the Republicans seem to think would make good presidential timber. And Lindsey Graham, what's Lindsey Graham hanging around for? Well, I could tell you, but I don't want to piss anybody else off any more than I have already tonight. The Pentagon has issued a report, a new Defense Department report that was asked for by President Obama. President Obama said to the Defense Department, I want you to review detainee operations at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And I want you to tell me what's going on down there. And so the Defense Department did. And it concluded that the operation at Guantanamo does not torture detainees, but rather treats them humanely and in accordance with the Geneva Convention. The report was sent on to the president, who has ordered the closing of this torture hole within a year. The report was released to the public today. It was prepared for the president, who has ordered the closing of Guantanamo within a year. The report was prepared by the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, Vice Admiral Patrick Walsh. And it was sent to Obama over the weekend. The review, put together by the DOD, recommends that high-value and violent detainees be allowed to pray and have recreation time in groups. The report says, quote, in our opinion, the key to socialization is providing more human-to-human contact, more recreational opportunities with several detainees together, intellectual stimulation, and group prayer, end quote.
A traveler on an airline had his name on a secret list. He was taking away with his laptop, and as he left, he called out to me. I met me at Guantanamo. I heard the girls are sweeter there. Meet me at Guantanamo.
End Your Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
So the Pentagon releases their report on detainee operations at Guantanamo Bay. And they conclude that the operation there does not torture detainees, but rather treats them humanely and in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. They recommend, the report recommends, that they all be allowed to play together and pray together and have books and human-to-human contact and recreational opportunities. And the review also recommends resolving the continued detention of detainees who are not listed as enemy combatants and are being held without charges. Yeah, that'd be a good idea, wouldn't it? Some of them have been held there for going on 8 years now with no charges, nothing. No chance to confront their accusers, nothing. Because they are this made-up thing called an enemy combatant. So they are non-persons. In addition, the Pentagon report endorses the videotaping of interrogations in all detention camps to, confirm humane treatment. Well, meantime, in the Guardian of the UK, Binyam Mohamed, who will return. Is he the guy that went back today? Or is he's on his way? The Guardian reveals that Binyan Mohammed, suffering from a huge range of injuries after being beaten by U.S. guards at Guantanamo right up to the point of his departure on Saturday. That's according to the first detailed accounts of his treatment inside Guantanamo. During medical examinations last week, doctors have to be American doctors because he just has arrived or will arrive tomorrow back in the UK. Doctors discovered injuries and ailments resulting from apparently brutal treatment and detention. He was found to be suffering from bruising, organ damage, stomach complaints, malnutrition, sores to feet and hands, severe damage to ligaments, as well as profound emotional and psychological problems, which had been exacerbated by the refusal of Guantanamo's guards to give him counseling. Mohammed's British lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, said his client had been beaten dozens of times inside Guantanamo. With the most recent abuse occurring during recent weeks, he said the attorney said, quote, he has a list of physical ailments that covers two sheets of paper. What Binyam has been through should have been left behind in the Middle Ages, end quote. Well, that's just lawyer talk. And besides, somebody named Binyam Mohammed? Oh, what did Cheney call him? The worst of the worst. But you see, he was never charged with anything. Never brought to trial. This is the stain, folks, that is on us. It's on you. Don't try to pretend it isn't. It's a great big yellow stain across your back. And I don't care what your position is. I don't care if you are a nun who has sacrificed her entire life for peace and justice. I don't care if you work for a human rights organization. I don't care if you're a mouth-breathing, half-witted Republican. I don't care if you're a talk show host. You have this yellow stain on you, and it's there until you die because you're an American. Oh, I've got mine, too, of course. Mine really is uncomfortable. But it's there until we die. The only thing that might bleach a little bit of the stain out is if we brought to trial the people who did this in your name and my name. This was done in our name. Don't forget that. Don't forget that. You can't escape. You can't. Truth seeker or truth denier. I don't care who you are. If you're an American, the stain is on you for the rest of your life. You can't get away from it. You can't. It's there. Now, of course, I'm referring only to people over the age of 18. So, the Defense Department report says, no, it's really cool down here. A little hot, but that's only because of the geographic location of, after all, it is Cuba. hot Cuba, equator. But everything else, not a problem. I wonder what Barack Obama is going to do with the report. What else? What else we got here? Is somebody wanted to talk about the fiscal responsibility? Oh, okay. I guess not anymore. The number here is 800-989-1480. If you want to take a chance, I don't know when I'll get to the calls, but stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Life's too short to listen to right-wing radio. Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. The folks over at TV News Lies sent me a link here. The guy I was talking about, Binyam Mohammed, was returned today to the UK. He was captured in Pakistan in Pakistan in April 2002. American officials said he had been part of a conspiracy to detonate a dirty bomb on American soil. All charges against him were dismissed. Tortured beyond belief, huh? And now, how do you say, what do you think Binyam Mohammed will do now? What would you do? What would you do if you still had the ability inside you to resist psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, and you hadn't been beaten? I know what I would do. I would die because I would get a weapon and I would try to track down every single person who tortured me and try to kill them. That's what I would. I know myself. That's what I would do. So since they're all heavily armed, members of the CIA or the U.S. military or what have you, I would be shot very quickly before I ever had a chance to seek revenge. And seek revenge is exactly what I would do. There is no question it's what I would do. I wonder what Binyam Mohammed is going to do. Now, as far as the helicopter McCain thing, a couple of people have emailed me about this. Yes, I'm aware of what that's all about. It's not one or two helicopters. It's 28, I believe. And the helicopters were given to an Italian weapons manufacturer as a payoff to the Nazi premier, or whatever the hell he is, the prime minister of Italy, Berlusconi, who, remember, the forged documents about the uranium coming from Niger were forged in Italy by Italian members of the Italian government, Italian security, Italian thugs, Italian whatever, Italian Nazis, Italian fascists, like Berlusconi. And this is a payback. Normally, when I say normally, I think throughout the history of the military-industrial complex, every single contract for presidential helicopters has gone to a U.S. firm, Sikorsky Helicopters. Not this time. This time, a rather large order. You see, any president needs 28 helicopters, right? And so the order went to an Italian firm. It was payback. From Bush, because Berlusconi covered Bush's ass in the lies about these fake documents. It's an incredibly corrupt nest tapestry that's been woven by these global corporatists or capitalists or Nazis or fascists, whatever you want to call them. The terms are interchangeable now, completely interchangeable. So that's what that's all about. And I hadn't gotten to that topic yet, and will eventually get into it in detail. But the presidential helicopters now are not have not been built by an American firm. They've been built by an Italian firm. And I think it's the same firm that builds secured aircraft for the Iranians. Who else? Somebody else. But apparently U.S. helicopters are not good enough any longer. Or the Bush crime family, being the filth that they were, saw no problem in awarding a major U.S. Weapons contract to a foreign firm, to an Italian firm. It's a payoff, payback. Thank you. Thank you, boys. So that's what they got in return. You ever eat York peppermint patties? I used to eat the hell out of those things because they had no fat. York peppermint patties, you know, the candy, the round candy. They had no fat. Of course, they're loaded with carbs. This is back in the day when we thought fat was going to get us. And actually, it was carbohydrates. So I would pass on the really good stuff and eat York peppermint patties. And I got to the point where I really liked them. Well, the Hershey Company is closing the plant in Reading, Pennsylvania. After 23 years in Reading, Hershey is closing the plant, or closed it, I think, last Friday, moving production to a new factory it has built in Mexico. Son of a bitch. See? Now, Hershey says it will mean the loss of about 260 jobs in Reading. 260 jobs. So that will affect directly about maybe 4,000 or 5,000 other people, husbands and wives and children and restaurant owners and hairdressers and shoe repair shops and gas stations. But Hershey. So York peppermint patties are now to be made at a plant in Monterrey, Mexico. Now, of course, this was announced 2 years ago, so doesn't really count. It's a move by Hershey to eliminate 1,500 jobs and to end one-third of its existing production lines. So York peppermint patties now, or in the very near future, will be made in Monterrey, Mexico. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, huh? Hershey chocolate, Hershey York peppermint patties. That makes a lot of sense. Isn't capitalism wonderful? Now, why do you suppose they're doing that? Is it because they just can't afford to make peppermint patties here anymore? Huh? Is that it? Is it because those lousy union workers, if they are union workers at the plant in Reading, Pennsylvania, you know, are making, Christ, are probably making, what, $9, $10, $11 an hour, right? And then I got this from Bob, who wrote in today. He says, Mike, I live in Los Angeles, and he says, I was out shopping. I went to a market. I needed garlic, and I was out shopping at a market, and I saw the sign that said it came from China. So I put them back. And I asked someone in the store if there was some kind of a joke, because Gilroy, California is probably the global center of garlic production, and it's about a two-hour drive from this market that Bob was in. And he says, quote, are we that much in debt to China that we have to buy garlic also? Yeah, I've been in Gilroy. I went to the garlic festival one time. Oh, my God. Ever tasted garlic ice cream? Don't laugh. But garlic grown in China, 2 hours away from... I mean, somebody could God, I can't stand this. Somebody could pick boxes of garlic in Gilroy, put them in backpacks, and walk to L.A., to this market, quicker than shipping them from China, much zero carbon footprint in the transportation, because I said somebody could walk. Garlic grown in China showing up in markets in Los Angeles. Thanks, Bob. Crazy. And how about those crazy Republican governors who are saying, no, we don't want no stinking money. We don't want no stinking money. Bobby Jindal. What is up with this guy from New Orleans, this new governor of New Orleans, Bobby Jindal? Has he become the new poster boy of insane Republicans? Now, he's not a European-American either. Right? He's not white. He really isn't. So this is another attempt, but he is a Republican. This is another move by the Republicans to show the colored folks in this country that they really are the big tent party. They got Bobby Jindal and Alan Keyes. Huh? How about that? But Bobby Jindal has decided he does not want this $90 million in recovery funding that would have benefited 25,000 Louisiana residents. Doesn't want it. Doesn't want it. According to, is it Think Progress? Where'd I get this? When President Obama signed the Economic Recovery and Reinvestment Act last week, it included three different provisions to benefit unemployed workers. The first provided funding to states that allowed for a $25 per week increase in benefits. The second extended the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, which gives 20 weeks of federally funded unemployment benefits to individuals, quote, who had already collected all regular state benefits, end quote. While the third provision widened the pool of people eligible to receive unemployment benefits. Well, how did Louisiana Republican governor react to that? I'll tell you in a minute.
Truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, I think I made a mistake in the location of Gilroy. John in L.A. wants me to know it's about 80 miles south of San Francisco, not as close to L.A. as I thought. Okay, thanks, John. So Bobby Jindal. And by the way, this is the guy who, if I remember right, when he was in college, didn't he do some exorcisms because he's a Catholic? Jesus Christ.
I'm still working on how I'm going to live without peppermint baddies.
I know. Anyway, Governor Bobby Jindal announced his intention today to oppose changing state law to allow his Louisiana citizens to qualify for the second two unemployment provisions. That would be 20 weeks of federally funded unemployment benefits to those who had already collected all the regular state benefits, and the widening the pool of people eligible to receive unemployment benefits. So Jindal says no. He said the state would only be accepting money to increase the unemployment insurance payments for those who currently qualify. So in all, Jindal turned away nearly $100 million in federal aid for his state's unemployed residents. Further, as the National Employment Law Project projected on February 13th, the extension, the unemployment, emergency unemployment compensation extension alone would have benefited 24,981 Louisiana residents. Jindal justified his decision by claiming that expanding unemployment benefits would result in tax increases for businesses. But it is not clear why participating in the expanded unemployment insurance program would result in tax increases for business. By Jindal's own estimate, the recovery package would have funded his state's unemployment expansion for 3 years, at which point the state could, if it chose to do so, phase out the program. As New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin suggested earlier today, perhaps Jindal's presidential ambitions are clouding his judgment. I think Jindal is a little bit high from all the Oscars that Slumdog Millionaire won last night, you think? So if you live in New Orleans, your governor has said, no, we don't need no stinking money. And it's not just the New Orleans governor. You want some more? From the House of Representatives, Frank Lucas. Here's one. He's a Republican from Oklahoma. He went home and told his constituents that he would get his, what he calls, fair share of the recovery package money. According to the Edmond, Oklahoma Sun, Frank Lucas went home and said, "I will work with you as I worked with your member of Congress and your U.S. senators, and we will get our fair share. We all need to work very aggressively to make sure that every community that qualifies should be a recipient of whatever we can find in that bill." Now, that was in the Edmond Sun newspaper, February 18th. However, Mr. Lucas voted against the recovery package twice. He also attacked the recovery package, stating, quote, "The federal government does not create wealth." That was back in January. Congressman Heath Shuler, Democrat, North Carolina, hosts a recovery package workshop, says he is prepared to fight for his fair share, according to the Citizen Times newspaper. He's a Democrat. He said, "I didn't vote for it, but that doesn't mean that I don't support Western North Carolina getting its fair share. We're prepared to fight for that." He told some 220 local officials gathered at the Asheville Renaissance Hotel in Asheville, North Carolina, for a workshop on how local governments can plan and apply for stimulus funding. Congressman Democrat Heath Shuler twice voted against the recovery package. Aren't these guys great? Greg Walden, congressman from Oregon, Republican, vowed to direct recovery package money to his district. According to the Mail Tribune newspaper, Representative Walden said, quote, "I figure my job is to try and do whatever I can to clear the hurdles and get the projects going and the people back to work using these funds. They're going to be spent somewhere. I hope they are spent mostly in this region. The part that is encouraging is the speed in which the agencies appear to want to move forward with projects," end quote. That's from February 19th. But not that long ago, Congressman Walden voted against the recovery package twice. Congressman Walden attacked the stimulus on February 13th, saying, quote, "If this is truly supposed to be a stimulus that produces jobs, this bill fails on that account. There are much better ways to produce jobs and keep jobs than to spend money the way they are spending money," end quote. Well, Congressman Walden, my goodness, didn't you 6 days later tell your constituents how you're damn sure going to get your piece and just bring and do all kinds of good things back in the home district? Congressman Glenn Thompson, Republican of Pennsylvania, he told his constituents he hoped massive spending would benefit his people. The Daily Collegian newspaper reported Congressman Glenn Thompson, who represents the 5th District at a national level, said he hoped the residents within the county would benefit from the plan's massive spending and tax cuts. But in opposing the stimulus, Mr. Thompson cited reckless spending and insufficient tax cuts. He also voted against the recovery package twice. Oh, he also criticized the package, stating, "How does borrowing from foreign countries actually benefit us?" My goodness. Does this sound a little hypocritical? Well, it is not. It's just the way Republicans and Blue Dog Democrats operate. Welcome back. It is about 7 past the hour. We're just talking about, this is the Malloy program. Talking about some of these members of Congress who can't wait to get their hands on the stimulus money, but what did they do to make sure that the stimulus money flowed to their constituents? Nothing. They did everything they could to stop it flowing. But all Republican members of Congress are liars, cheats, and thieves. And a handful of Democratic members of the House are also the so-called blue dog Democrats. They're real scum. They should just go ahead and become Republicans, or the Democratic Party ought to throw them out, put them in the Republican Party where they belong, so that when the Republican Party is finally murdered, some of these guys will, and not a few women also, who claim to be Democrats and are not, that they will leave us alone then. Leonard Lance, here's one, a Republican in New Jersey. He said that a recovery package funded program was, quote, a classic example of a shovel-ready project. It's that good. According to ABC News, in New Jersey, Representative Leonard Lance toured an Army Corps of Engineer construction site that will likely get stimulus dollars. And he said, this is a classic example of a shovel-ready project. It's ready to go, just waiting for money. But as the liberal website Blue Jersey notes, Congressman Lance had penned an op-ed against the bill, writing, quote, only a fraction of the dollars are targeted toward shovel-ready projects that will keep and create immediate jobs, end quote. And he also voted against the Republic or the recovery package twice. John Micah, Republican of Florida, gushed about funds secured in the recovery package. According to McClatchy newspapers, Representative John Micah was gushing after the House of Representatives voted Friday to pass the big stimulus plan. The Florida Republican said at a press conference, I applaud President Obama's recognition that high-speed rail should be part of America. According to Political.com, Congressman Diaz-Balart was among the 9 Republican House members from Florida, all who said no to the stimulus, who joined 9 of their Democratic colleagues, all yeses, in asking the feds to grant a waiver, giving them access to, you guessed it, hundreds of millions of dollars in state stabilization stimulus cash. Now, of course, Congressman Micah voted against the recovery package twice. Isn't this irritating? I suggested a couple of weeks ago that any Republican who and Democrat who voted no, I think there were 10 House members who are Democrats, who voted no on the stimulus package, and all the Republicans, every last one of these rat bastards should just be told, okay, no money for you, just like the soup Nazi. No money for you. Get out of my store. No money for you. And let them go back to their home districts and say, well, everybody else is getting job stimulation and funds for deferred maintenance on our bridges and roads and schools, but we don't get any. Why is that?
Because you said no, you son of a bitch.
You know, why not make them face their constituents? But no, they're going back to their home districts and beaming and crowing and talking about how, well, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. Yeah, this is great. This is wonderful. It just goes on and on, on and on and on and on. Congressman Ken Calvert, Republican in California, announced that he would claim as much recovery money as we can. According to the newspaper, the Press Enterprise, Representative Calvert said, all of us in the Inland Empire, that's in California, we'll do what we can to direct as much money as we can. But he voted twice against the recovery package. And he complained that the recovery package forces the middle class, quote, onto a troubling kind of public dependency, end quote. Well, Congressman Calvert, then why are you now saying, all of us in the Inland Empire will do what we can to direct as much money as we can. Hot damn. Ball, boy, back them old dump trucks up here with the money. We're ready to rock and roll. Pete Hoekstra, Republican of Michigan, praised what he called the generous recovery package benefits. According to the Hill blog, Representative Hoekstra communicated through Twitter, quote, "If you know of someone thinking of buying a first home, now may be the time. Stimulus incentive is very, very generous. Up to $8,000. Check it out." But, of course, Congressman Hoekstra voted against the recovery package twice, and he called the recovery package a spending spree. It goes on and on and on. These people, these Republican members of Congress are just truly, truly disgusting. Truly disgusting. I'm sure they are pissing off the leadership of the Republican Party, the pig Rush Limbaugh, and his two assistants, the hoe from Wasilla and Joe the plumber, with these kinds of statements, getting all giddy and lightheaded because they're going to get some money for their nearly broke districts, their districts where jobs have disappeared, infrastructure is crumbling, education is in the toilet, health care practically doesn't exist anymore. So here comes some of that communist money. Yes, indeed. You know Barack Obama's a communist. You knew that, didn't you? Yeah, he's a socialist communist. What's the difference? Well, they're both, you know, one of them.
Ah.
Besides, he's not even an American citizen, is he? But I'll take the damn money. You hypocritical sons of bitches, every last one of you. And not just the members of Congress who are this way, but the people in these primarily, 187 Democrats or Republicans said no. Is it 187? Said no. So all of you Republicans who live in these districts, you mean to tell me that you are going to take this money? When the man or woman that you sent to Washington to represent you said no, that you all didn't want any of it, and now it's coming anyway, and you're gonna take it? Are you really gonna do that? Well, you're a bunch of hypocritical sons of bitches too, then, aren't you? Huh? Yeah, you are. Is this what they taught you in Sunday school? Is this what your mom and daddy taught you when you were a kid growing up? To be hypocritical, to be a liar, to say one thing and do something else? Is this what you learned in your churches and your wherever the hell you go to get your weekly dose of religion? Is this what you learned? Huh? Is it? Really? Wow. Is this part of that prosperity Christianity stuff that I've been reading about? Or not? What is this? Maybe some of you Republican Christian folk who talk about how Barack Obama is just bringing socialism and communism and you send your representative to Washington to kill stuff like this, and now your representative got overridden. So surely, you do have an ounce of decency left, don't you? You are going to say, no, Congressman, we don't want this money because we are good Christian, pull ourselves up by the bootstrap, honest talking people. And when we say we don't want money, we mean it. You're going to do that, aren't you, folks? Huh? I can't hear you. No, you're not. You want to know how crazy it's gotten with marijuana in this country? I mean, you would think over the past 70, 80 years it couldn't have gotten any crazier, but this is from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I'll tell you about it in a second. A soldier who had both of his legs blown off fighting for corporate America and George Bush in Iraq. Well, I'll tell you when we come back. Stay with us.
Ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's More Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Scott West is the guy I'm about to tell you about. He's 23 years old, and he was in Iraq. He lost both of his legs in a roadside bomb explosion, December 2005, and. There is an organization, Home for Our Troops is the name of it, Homes for Our Troops. And it's an organization that collects money and they buy houses that grievously wounded returning GIs can handle. You know, I mean, if it's somebody who's confined to a wheelchair forever, the hallways are larger. If it's somebody whose legs have been blown off, accommodations are made. If it's somebody with one arm or no arms, it's a great idea. Homes for Our Troops. So Scott West, who's 23, qualified. His new home featured wide hallways, voice-activated lighting, everything tailored to this young man's needs. And then a developer offered to give Scott and his wife, his new wife, Samantha, a free lot where the house could be built. And the couple thought this was too good to be true. Scott said, quote, "This was a place where I thought I could live the rest of my life and never have to worry." Well, in January, they got married. They went on their honeymoon, this young couple. So in January, the charity, Homes for Our Troops, took back the house. Said, no, you can't move in. After learning that Scott had been arrested on marijuana charges 2 years ago and had pled guilty this past December to a felony of possession with intent to distribute. Last week, a judge placed 23-year-old Scott West on 5 years probation. Now, Scott West, who lost both of his legs to a bomb in Iraq, he acknowledges that he deserved to be punished. Despite his guilty plea, he insists he never sold marijuana. He believes the charity, Homes for Our Troops, overreacted. Scott West said of the donated house, "It was something to help me. It wasn't like a privilege to be taken from me." The founder of Homes for Our Troops, somebody named John Gonzalez, did not respond to requests for an interview with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. This organization has built more than three dozen homes nationwide. Since it was established in 2004, it has about two dozen more homes under construction. A spokeswoman for the charity, Homes for Our Troops, said it was grateful for West's service and sacrifice in the military. You want to know a little bit about this guy? He said he never tried alcohol in high school and he only used marijuana once. Then he graduated from high school, joined the Army, reached his first duty station, Fort Stewart, Georgia. He said, "I was drinking and smoking a week later." Well, military do that to you. Within a month, he deployed to Iraq, where alcohol, marijuana, and hashish were available, readily available. He served as a reconnaissance scout in the 3rd Infantry Division. 3 days before he was scheduled to leave Iraq, a roadside bomb detonated beneath his Humvee. He spent 14 months recovering at Walter Reed, where he learned about this organization, Homes for Our Troops. He decided to apply. In February 2007, he went back to his home, Branson, Missouri, moved into a two-bedroom condo he had purchased with a $100,000 insurance payment he received for his injuries. He was praised in local news reports. He was granted honorary membership in local veterans organizations. He spoke to elementary and high school students about overcoming adversity. Oh, and he also smoked reefer. In October 2007, police officer pulled him over for driving without headlights. Cops smelled marijuana, asked to search the vehicle. They found less than 12 ounces. West spent 3 days in the Taney County Jail. He said, quote, "I'd never been in trouble," end quote. So the couple now lives in the condo where it's difficult to use a wheelchair. At night, Scott West says when he removes his prosthetics, he walks on his hands. That makes it difficult to reach the sink or the thermostat or open cabinets or the refrigerator. Robert Holland, a Navy veteran of World War II and a member of a disabled American veterans chapter in the Branson area, said many veterans use drugs to get through combat. Adjusting to civilian life isn't easy, this veteran added. It's a trap, the veteran said, that not only him but others fall into. But they went over there and fought just like I did. By the way, Robert Holland, the Navy veteran, is 85. And young Mr. West said he is sorry and feels he let many people down because he smoked some reefer. He had hoped to have a new home, go to college, have children. And now he delivers pizzas. So, 23 years old, two legs blown off in Iraq. Charity gave him a house and then took it back because he smoked reefer. How about that?
Uh-oh, he just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
At 25 before the hour. Email here from, I guess I'm not supposed to give his name. All right. Hi, Mike. On Saturday, I was at a bar drinking, as you do in such places, when someone made a comment regarding economic reform policies that put me over the edge. The person said, quote, I couldn't support the government giving out checks to help the economy because some N-words in Detroit would be getting them, too. That's what the person said. I started to shake, and while I'm not a violent person, the rage I felt was something that even scares me in retrospect. I'm white. I live in Metro Detroit. After some yelling at me, or by me at this person and his supporters, I left. Nothing physical came of it, but that was only by matter of chance. However, I told this person if they ever say such things in front of me again, they would learn to regret it. But now I feel horrible for what I did. I belittled this person and threatened them with physical harm. As a firm supporter of free speech, I feel that person has the right to say whatever they want, whenever they want, even if it's something as stupid and disgusting as the above. But should I feel bad for what I did and how I felt? Maybe the lesson is to react in a different way, but I'm not sure what that way is. I'm not sure if something like this is even worthy for the air. I just think I need someone to tell me it's okay sometimes to say enough is enough. Well, yeah, I think so. And first of all, free speech, you got to be clear about what you mean by that. I'm not sure where the term came from, but in the First Amendment, it says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. In other words, the state. And that's come to mean that any official government authority, whether it's the executive branch, legislative branch, state branches, you know, whatever, that the state can't pass laws abridging free speech, telling people they can and can't say something. By the same token, free speech is not really free speech. I mean, there's certain things you can't say. That's why we have laws against we have laws in slander, libel. If all speech, you could say anything you wanted, then we wouldn't have those laws. There are things you can't say. Here in Georgia, there are things that if you say them, they are called legal definition fighting words. It is now acceptable here in Georgia, and this cracks me up since I'm a gun owner and I carry a weapon. This really cracks me up. If someone says to me something now when I'm out in public that I consider to be threatening, it is now a defense for me to pull out my gun and shoot them. That's right. Now, I may get arrested and charged, but I now have a legal defense. Your Honor, my attorney would say, what this man said to Mike Malloy made him feel that he was threatened. To a degree necessary for Mike Malloy to pull out his weapon and shoot the son of a bitch. I mean, free speech is, I don't know who came up with that. There is responsible speech, and there is the fact that the government cannot pass laws restricting free speech. But if somebody in a bar says something that pisses you off, punch their lights out. Hell yeah. Or if you don't feel like doing that, do what you did. Of course it's okay to say enough is enough. You say, to as a firm supporter of free speech, I feel that persons have the right to say whatever they want, whenever they want. That's not true. That's not true. Even the justice on the Supreme Court so long ago famously said free speech does not give someone the right to falsely hire fire in a crowded theater. I mean, you can't do that because the result might be the deaths of people who are responding to your lie. So there is the idea that anything goes in terms of speech, what you say in this country, that's simply not true. It never has been. I could wind up in the next 5 minutes with a libel suit against me because I said something about somebody, and somebody would report it to someone else who would finally get to the person's attorney, and the next thing you know, I would have a slander suit or a libel suit, or slander, really, because libel is that's the printed word, right? The written word. So free speech is kind of a misnomer. It means, yeah, you have the right to say anything you want if you're willing to take the responsibility, if you want to go to court, if you want to be charged with some sort of a involuntary manslaughter. If you do scream fire falsely in a crowded theater and 18 people are trampled to death, your ass is in trouble and you can't claim free speech. You see what I'm saying? So somebody referring to people using the N-word in a bar, if that offends you, there's a couple ways to handle it. You can invite them outside. Of course, there's probably a law in Detroit, in the Metro Detroit area where you live, against fighting in public. But you know, you can invite them out in the parking lot. It's private property. I don't know, and just beat the living hell out of them, I guess. I don't know. Here in Georgia, if I'm a black man and somebody calls me the N-word now, I have a right to put a bullet between his eyes. Yeah, I do. I really do. Well, not a right to, but it will be a defense when the police come and arrest me. I'll say, well, according to Georgia law now, I have a right to draw my weapon and use it if I feel that someone is saying something that is a threat to me. Of course, that's here in the South. That's here in Georgia, and they would never, ever, 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 ever expect a black man to do that. That's for white people. That law's for white people. Jesus, God. It's getting curiouser and curiouser, isn't it? Wow. Gail Eva writes, Mike, the news of Obama deciding to send more troops to Afghanistan fills me with a sense of dread that I just can't shake. And that's on top of all the other major anxieties surrounding the global economic meltdown, climate change, steadily creeping fascism, ongoing fears of more terrorism, no matter where it's perpetrated, and on and on and on. I sometimes feel like I should search out a Himalayan cave and meditate on world peace. It might be more useful than protesting another goddamn war. As a regular listener to your show, one of your so-called 37, I often feel the impulse to give feedback but rarely act on it, not because I don't care enough, but mostly due to writer's block, and partly due to the overwhelming number of issues and the speed with which they arise and fly by. The biggest reason I'm getting this email together is to express my concern that with all the turmoil going on, if you should abruptly be off the air for whatever reason, I hope you will CC me an update of what's happening and where you might next resurface. Now I'm going nowhere. I don't want to lose touch with you since it took a long time to find you on the radio. Your show is always so engaging and candid. I'm deeply grateful for the unflinching honesty, the fearlessness and righteous indignation you bring to each and every program. I love how you strive to cover a wide array of topics and dig the way you include dark humor, music and cultural references, spiritual values, empathy and tenderness when appropriate. Keep up the great work. Why did I read this? Apparently, I didn't read that last paragraph before I read it on the air. Signed, Gail. P.S. I hope you won't mind if I offer a small correction of your citing the word karma as Sanskrit for balance, since it's actually the word for action. Karma is the Sanskrit word for action. In common parlance, it's often modified with good or bad. I believe you meant to use the word to describe the concept of karmic balance. And for the record, the Sanskrit word for balance is tulaa. Well, see, Kathy, you learn something every day. I thought karma meant balance, but what it means is action. All right, thanks, Gail. And regarding going into Afghanistan, according to military officials, during last week's meeting with Gates, Secretary Gates, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Pentagon's secret tank, the President Obama specifically asked the people, what's the end game where it concerns U.S. military's strategy for Afghanistan? When asked what the answer was, one military official told NBC News, quote, frankly, we don't have one, end quote. Now, that is while Obama is finalizing plans to send tens of thousands of more troops to Afghanistan as part of what is called a push to beat back the resurgent Taliban and secure regions of Afghanistan that are beyond the reach of the weak central government in Kabul, end quote. And NBC's Jim Mikliszewski reports that Pentagon officials haven't been able to provide an answer to Obama's concern about having an endgame strategy in place. New York Times reported recently, quote, even as Mr. Obama's military planners prepare for the first wave of the new Afghanistan surge, there is growing debate, including among those who agree with the plan to send more troops, about whether or how the troops can accomplish their mission. And just what is the mission? Right. When asked what the end game is, what the exit strategy is, the military geniuses who have had 8 years of doing anything they goddamn please, thanks to Dick Cheney, don't have an answer. Well, that's kind of curious.
Toe to toe, touch and go, give a cheer, get your souvenir. People running around in circles, don't know what they're headed for. Everybody's crying peace on earth just as soon as we win this war. So straight ahead.
Ten before the hour, thanks to our stellar crew tonight for assisting in the program. Ian Huff, who engineered and answered your calls, although we certainly didn't get to a lot of calls, did we? Ben Birch, who is our technical advisor, Sharon Gordy, military affairs correspondent. Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf are the program's ethical advisors. Bruce Enberg, our economic advisor, and the executive producer is Catherine Bay. Regarding the story of the 23-year-old soldier who had his legs blown off because he was a forward observer or whatever it's called now, Ruth in Phoenix writes, Mike, an Army scout is one of the most dangerous jobs the Army has. Few ever make it back at all. They're the first out there. I'm so disgusted by the story of this brave soldier and what has been done to him. I can't bear to listen, especially when you look at the cowards in the Bush administration that caused this, and we can't get them to a court, and they persecute this brave soldier because he smokes some weed. There is no justice in this world. Seems like that sometimes, doesn't it, Ruth? Yeah, to give a double amputee, somebody had his legs blown off by a roadside bomb 5 days. It always seems to work this way, 5 days before he was supposed to return or circulate out of Iraq. And the charity gives him a house. They find out that he smokes reefer, had some reefer in possession. They take it away from him. It's just madness. It's just madness. And the people who really profit from war, they never have anything taken away from them, do they? Huh? The weapons manufacturers, the arms manufacturers, the smugglers, the weapons smugglers, the people that provide all this death and destruction, whether it's United States providing the Israeli army with white phosphorus so they can incinerate Palestinian children in Gaza, doesn't make any difference. Oh, but Mike, isn't that against international law? Yeah, but you know, stuff happens, right? When you are trying to wipe out a civilian population, you have got to use efficient weaponry. In Southeast Asia, we used Agent Orange and other lethal combinations of stuff. The Israelis use white phosphorus. Agent Orange wouldn't quite make it in areas where Palestinians live because there's very little foliage, especially very little farms, or very few farms, very few olive groves. The Israeli military has blown them all to pieces or expropriated them. Anyway, let me see. Let's talk with David, who is calling from somewhere in the Great White North, listening on the internet. David, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey, how you doing, Mike?
Yeah, what's on the background? You got to turn it down.
Oh, actually, I just turned it down because I figured you got to my call.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, what I wanted to talk to you about is I originally said I wanted to talk about Alan Keyes and Guantanamo.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still want to talk about Alan Keyes, but I'd like to skip Guantanamo if that's okay with you, because I think
sure.
What you're talking about is much more pertinent.
Sure.
I'm guessing you saw the MSNBC clip as I did of what Alan Keyes calling him a radical communist.
Yeah, incredible stuff. Unbelievable
stuff. Yeah, incredible stuff.
Yeah.
Now, here's what I find funny. See, people wonder why Alan Keyes never wins at anything, because he says ridiculous things like this. Okay, that was radical in and of itself.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I think that he could get a job in comedy. I kid you not, I laughed so hard when he said that. First of all, he sounds like Marvin the Martian. I don't know why this guy can be taken seriously at all.
Yeah, he is a cartoon character. He is, but the problem
is... You know Marvin the Martian.
Yeah, I do.
That's
but
what he sounds like. He sounds exactly like him.
Yeah, but David, the problem here, Alan Keyes is not a threat to anybody anywhere at any time. He's a jerk. But there are people listening to him.
Mm-hmm.
Who may decide that Alan Keyes speaks directly from God, like George Bush said God told him to invade two countries. So if somebody hears Alan Keyes, say a Timothy McVeigh type, there's no telling what could happen. You see what
exactly.
I'm saying?
Exactly. And what I also wanted to mention, too, is, and this goes to what you, I'm taking it you saw the Right America Feeling Wronged documentary, didn't you?
I did not.
Okay, well, Alexandra Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi's daughter, did an HBO documentary called Right America Feeling Wronged. And what it was about is conservative voices during the campaign. And the only way I could describe this is, and you probably know what I mean, is horrifyingly hilarious.
Yeah, I hear you.
Because in the Deep South, and you know you're in the Deep South, I mean, look, it was just the dumbest people ever. Okay, this guy said say no to socialism, had it on his T-shirt, and didn't even spell socialism right. He forgot the A. All right? And then this other guy, he goes, I'm just not too partial to blacks. In fact, I don't even think you should vote. Why? Because you're a woman. What does that have to do with it? Well, I mean, come on. You're a woman. And I mean, and these people, I just feel so bad for them. I don't know if to feel bad for them or to be angry at them. And I just don't know. And this is what the Republican Party has become.
Sure.
The know-nothing party. You know what I mean? And these are, and then you get the people we were talking about earlier, the senators and congressmen, the pull yourself up by the bootstrap people.
Right, right.
I don't know about you, but that phrase itself, pull yourself up by bootstraps, is the funniest thing I've ever heard.
It is.
You know, when people tell me, I don't know what everyone's complaining about, I pulled myself up by the bootstraps. I don't know if they want me to applaud their work ethic or applaud their fashion sense for buying boots with straps on
with straps
them.
Straps on
them,
yeah.
To get pulled up at any specific time.
Yeah, I wish somebody would tell me, what the hell is a boot strap to begin with? I've never seen one.
Boots I know have either zippers or laces at the bottom that are not strong enough to actually be pulled up from. You know what I mean?
David, man, we're out of time. I know you were on hold for a long time. I'll tell you what, call back in tomorrow night. We'll talk, all right?
All right, we will talk. Thanks a lot, Mike.
All right, man. Appreciate you checking in. Take care. Take care. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm leaving everybody on hold. I apologize. We'll get to you tomorrow night. Can you call back tomorrow night? Okay, call back tomorrow night. As far as the rest of this evening, take care. All right? Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is On Second Thought, Radio Network.